We're here. We're the Bitter End Podcast, and we'd like to say welcome to you.
Hiya.
My name's Todd Jordan, and I am joined by...
Mr. Tom Denny.
And we are back together once again, back to dive headlong into the Highlander franchise with the fourth episode of our second season for a film called Highlander 3, The Sorcerer.
Damn right.
We just watched the trailer for it.
Yep, so we're back in the live action territory, people.
No more cartoons, at least for a little while.
Yep, so our big boy Lambo's back. Christopher Lambert is back.
He's talking weird. He's doing what he does. From the trailer alone, the budget of this film looks like it is a bit more. Like a little bit more.
Yeah, I was quite... I thought that maybe by this point in the franchise, they would be toning it down and just kind of like, oh, man, do we still have to make these?
Someone still had faith.
Yeah, like it looks as though, from what I gather, that like Mario Van Peebles is... he's playing the Highlander's enemy in this. And I get the impression that they have been enemies for a long time.
Yeah, the trailer's got a lot more of the like historical stuff in it. There's definitely some French Revolution in there.
There's the Highlands of Scotland.
There's some Genghis Khan-y era stuff.
Yeah, there's like a desert and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's, of course, a big fight in like an abandoned warehouse or an industrial complex with loads of explosions.
What year is this film?
That's a good question.
Oh, we covered this. It's the same year as The Adventure Begins, which is 1994, Tom.
It is 1994.
Another one that came out when I was 11.
Yeah, came out in November of 94. This film also, as we mentioned before, has a lot of different titles. So it's Highlander 3, The Sorcerer, Highlander 3, The Final Dimension, Highlander 3, The Magician, and Highlander 3, The Final Conflict. It's as though this franchise is a big hot mess.
Who knew?
From the things we've already seen, who would have guessed? I think it looks pretty fun.
It looks all right. Like old Lambface is looking beefier. He looks like he's been bulking up a bit for it.
Yeah, he's still wearing that horrible trench coat he insists on wearing in all the films.
Yeah. There's a bit in the trailer where he goes, "Yeah, can be only one."
Classic.
And as soon as that happened, I was like, "Ooh, yes, I actually want to see this one."
Yeah. I mean, they keep on saying there can be only one. Is the irony completely lost on the filmmakers? Who knows? There's also just like quite a nice little bit where it looks like he chops. I don't know what the power is. Like obviously, Mario Van Peebles is a sorcerer, but he like chops him in half with a sword and his legs keep on running.
I don't know if this is the end of the film.
Yeah, it looks like they might have shown the majority of the end of the film where everything explodes. But I'm up for it.
Yeah, like banging soundtrack for a little bit there. It sounded like it might be the music from Dune that they'd reworked, like the Toto soundtrack for Dune.
Yeah.
If just a little aside, Todd is a big fan of the music from Dune. If you aren't familiar with it, go check out the album.
Yeah. Now, we should dive into this pretty sharpish.
Yep.
But.
Hit me.
But.
Hit
November 94.
Hit me.
Highlander 3, The Sorcerer comes in.
Hit me.
IMDb has rated it. What do you think it is? So, just to recap.
Yep.
The first Highlander, 7.2.
Uh-huh.
Highlander 2, The Quickening, a 4.
What a crime.
Highlander, The Adventure Begins, 5.3.
That's an even bigger crime.
What do you think?
Do you know what? Judging by the trailer alone, judging by the feelings in my heart, I'm pumped. 7.7.
Nah, babe.
4.3.
Yeah, I know. Suddenly.
Getting a little hot under the collar there.
Yeah, yeah. But we should just go and see what this is all about, because I think there's going to be some changes once again to the Highlander lore, because as far as we're aware, if 2 is non-canonical, all the immortals are dead as per the events at the end of Highlander 1. So who is this sorcerer and what is his bag and what does he want with our good pal Lam Lam?
Let's go find out, Tom.
Okay.
Well done.
Good on you, Highlander.
You did it again.
Well... Yep, it's another Highlander film.
Yeah, it's another Highlander film. It felt very much to me like an attempt to go back to basics, but that somewhere along the way, they'd forgotten what the basics were.
Yeah, or they forgot the basics that Highlander 1 wraps everything up pretty nicely and you don't need to do a sequel.
Yeah, they kind of tick a lot of the boxes of like things from Highlander 1 that people might want to see again.
Yes.
It definitely does not even come close to referencing anything at all from the second one.
Yeah. A lot of fan service going on here. Which is not a bad thing.
I enjoyed the film. Yeah. I enjoyed the vast majority of the film.
There are some good bits. There are some bad bits.
Yes, I did not enjoy every element of it. Tell you what I did enjoy. Mario Van Peebles.
Mario Van Peebles knocks it out of the park.
The PB&J himself is so good as the villain in this.
Yeah, I mean, I just even want to say that maybe... I don't know, is he even more enjoyable than the Kurgan?
He's so much more. I mean, yeah, here we are again. At the moment, we're 4 for 4 of Highlander films with a villain whose name begins with a K.
Yes, so Mario Van Peebles plays Kane.
Kane! And he's so good.
Yeah, he's basically, if you liked Clancy Brown doing the Kurgan and all of his, like, his, like, cartoonish villainy and all that, you get that in spades. With Mario Van Peebles, but he's a little bit more like kind of like a developed character. He has a little bit more talk time rather than just laughing like crazy. But there's still plenty of laughing. Oh, yes.
Oh, you better believe there's laughing.
Yes, indeed you do.
Before we get too deep down the laughter rabbit hole, Tom, what the fuck is this film about, man?
Right, okay. So we open the film with Connor McLeod doing Ramirez's monologue from the beginning of Highlander, the first of many bits of fan service. And then it kind of goes off into, you get just, it's like black screen and him talking, close up of Lam Lam's face, being like, I'm Connor McLeod of the Clan McLeod.
Yes, my forehead is 80% of my body weight.
Yeah. And then he talks about, you flash back to where Ramirez has just died in part one, and it fills in the gap what happened after Ramirez dies and his first wife dies.
Yeah.
And he goes, apparently, to Japan to see the wizard Nakano, who is another immortal that lives in a cave, and he kind of, like, he assumes the Ramirez role of training him. Now, there's something new here about Nakano, is because he's a wizard. He has, as he like says, the power of illusion.
Of illusion!
Which means he can do stuff like basically turn a stick into a snake and a snake into a stick.
Those are the main things he can do.
And he can like make doubles of himself and things, and things like that. So he is training McLeod to... be a tip-top sword fighter, which I thought Ramirez had already done.
Not tip-top enough.
Yeah, he does this by basically throwing loads of grapefruit at McLeod, who is blindfolded and has to, like, chop the grapefruit in midair, which he does like a boss. And then he's like, you're ready now. and then he says, like, chop my head off so that you can absorb all of my powers and get the power of illusion. Because I guess, like Ramirez, like... he doesn't think that he's going to make it to the end.
Yeah.
To the gathering.
He doesn't care.
During this time, we get Kane, the evil Kane, who is got a very Genghis Khan vibe.
Yeah, super Genghis Khan-y. He's got a couple of cronies in tow. Mm. They all rock up on horseback at this little snowy Japanese village. And they're like, where's the sorcerer? And they're like, oh, up there in that cave. And they're like, cool, thanks for that. By the way, gonna kill you all. They kill everybody!
Kills everybody. And they basically bust in. Because I think, I don't know if they're looking for Nakano or they're looking for Connor?
No. They're looking for Nakano because of the peep machine, Mario Van Peebles, wants that power of illusion. And the only way to get that is to chop off Nakano's head.
Right, yes. So basically, he finds the cave. Nakano is kind of like, says to Connor, you have to get out of here.
Yeah, go!
Get out of here. I'll deal with this. And then he does this kind of like multiply thing and fights P. Diddy. Mm-hmm. And then he gets killed. And
Nakano gets killed.
Kane absorbs his power. In doing so, he gets like the quickening, which, as we know, with the quickening, makes everything in the world blow up.
Kaboom!
Yes, exactly. So the cave blows up. During this ruckus, Connor does leap out and gets stabbed by Kane, at which he has a flashback of him being stabbed by the Kurgan. Very nice. Then, okay. Cave blows up. Connor gets out of the cave.
Phew!
Kane and his two henchmen are stuck in the cave.
Yeah, trapped. There's a whole complete cave-in.
Yeah. And then...
it flashes forward to the year... 1994.
It does. In Japan.
In Japan still.
This film flashes all over the shop. I've got us. It's, I mean, if you thought the first one was a bit kind of like, oh, where are we now? This one is like, oh my God. Yeah. And we are introduced to Alex, who is, she is like the love interest, basically, of the film. She is...
she's an archaeologist.
Yeah, a bit like Brenda in the first film, maybe has a bit of a knowledge of swords. Mm-hmm. And she goes to an archaeological dig where they have found Nakano's cave.
Yeah, 400 years have passed since Cain was sealed within.
Yeah, and 1994, what has also passed is The Gathering. The events of the first film have been and gone.
So yeah, absolutely. So just to get it absolutely clear, the timeline in your head, guys, this takes place entirely after the events of the first film.
The Kurgan is dead.
The Kurgan is dead. It ignores the events of the second film.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is where things get a little bit sticky. But anyway, basically what happens is Cain and his goons, they get out of the cave.
Which means that this is where we get caught up, because at the end of the first film, MacLeod is not immortal anymore because he's defeated the Kurgan. He is the only one. And the prize is he's no longer immortal and he knows everything. Now, in the events of this film, 8 years have passed since that happened. Bearing in mind that all along, Cain was in this cave. So MacLeod was never the only one, because there was Cain and his two other mates who are also immortal were all in there. But fine, I guess they were sealed in an airtight Tupperware box, basically, and it didn't count. They come out of the cave. Connor MacLeod is like, oh, I can feel he's back. He's back. So now he's suddenly immortal again.
Or do you think that he was always immortal, but he just assumed that he was mortal?
Well, I guess at the end of the first one, he's like, I can have children now. I can feel it.
Ah, well, this is the thing. When we were back reintroduced to Connor MacLeod, he has a child.
And I was like, oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah, who is adopted. So he could have still been immortal.
You think he just got it wrong?
He could have just gotten it wrong. But
the first film ends with him going, I know everything.
Yes.
So, he literally says those words.
Yeah, let's not try and dig the filmmakers out of that hole for them.
Now, this is my only real sticking point with this film, is this bit. And I can kind of forgive him, because it's the rest of what happens is pretty fun.
Yeah. I don't know if I can let it go. It's pretty dumb.
So, MacLeod goes, I can feel it. He's back. Meaning...
Oh, that's because Cain kills one of his henchmen. He sends one of his henchmen out to look for MacLeod. And then he kills the other one just because...
Because he wants his strength to help him. MacLeod can feel it.
And then that's how he... Yeah.
Confusingly, at this point, MacLeod is in Marrakesh with his son, John. His adopted son, John. He goes, I can feel it. Cain is back. I can feel it. And so what does he do? He doesn't go to Japan where Cain is. No. He gets on a plane and flies to New York City so he can go walk around his old apartment.
Yeah, he's just kind of like, I need to go back to where it all began in the scene of the gathering.
Yep.
And he's like, and he just leaves his son behind.
He leaves his son behind in Marrakesh. Now this comes into play later.
Yeah, so already this is, we're yo-yoing back and forth.
The film is yo-yoing back and forth.
Like, Cain has just, like, sent, like, his crony to go and find him, which he does. He finds him in New York.
I don't know how this feudal Japanese warrior made it to New York with no money. He's got a sword. You can't take a sword on a plane, mate.
Yeah, but as we were surmising that because they're immortal and they can't drown, maybe he just walked from Japan along the bottom of the ocean
to New York. That would have taken years.
Yeah, they kind of gloss over that.
So he shows up in New York.
Oh yeah,
MacLeod like takes him out. That's totally cool.
But where he takes him out is that MacLeod is just like, he goes back to New York and he just walks down the middle of every street.
Yeah, with his big stupid Columbo coat on.
Yeah, with like cars flying everywhere. And like, he basically walks down a dark alley and gets mugged and shot.
Oh yeah, this bit is so insane.
Yeah,
bit is so amazing. So this is where we still think, oh, maybe he's human at this point. Like, maybe he's not immortal. He gets caught up with these random muggers. They shoot him and he's like, nah. And then this really like totally batshit kind of spaz rock jazz guitar solo score just goes and it's all like going crazy and there's a drum solo. It's like, bam, 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 bam. And then it follows right through to the hospital, and these doctors are trying to resuscitate him. And they go,
He's been shot.
These aren't bullet holes. And then the doctor stands around and says, what the fuck are you saying?
It's delivered, this line. It just cracked me up. It's delivered with such aggression.
Notify the police? Of course. What the fuck are you talking about?
It is the most aggressive thing that happens in this whole film, which has a lot of people getting their heads chopped off. It's just this doctor going, what the fuck are you talking about?
The doctor is sick of that person's shit, Tom. He's sick of it.
It's great. I enjoyed that.
He's immortal. He's immortal.
Yes,
he's
that's
fine.
Where he realizes he's immortal, and he goes crazy, and they lock him in a mental ward.
In like a massive, like, I had to check this whole mental asylum scene. I had to check that this was before 12 Monkeys, because it's so smacks of a lot of the stuff that happens in 12 Monkeys. This film came out 1 year before 12 Monkeys. There's a guy who completely unstereotypically thinks he's Napoleon. He's got a paper Napoleon hat. MacLeod convinces this guy that he's one of his soldiers, and so the Napoleon guy lets him loose. And then there's this super 12 Monkeys bit of it, like in the middle of the night, all the inmates like rattling the cages and being like really, really horrible stereotypes of mental people suffering from mental illness. It's not great, to be honest, but
and then basically that's when MacLeod fights Kane's goon.
And
kills him.
Nice bit of beheading.
Yeah.
Move on.
Moving on.
It at this point. And then Kane is just walking around New York just being like so sassy, man.
Oh, yeah. He's just walking around just being a total badass. It's some like really 90s little tiny shades.
Yeah, big leather jacket, like something from The Crow.
And like insane hair.
Crazy hair. Big nose ring.
Yeah. He's looking like he's just stepped out of a new metal band or something. He could be in Static X or something like that. So there's a lot of different threads going on here. Alex comes back to New York.
This is the archaeologist.
Yeah, she finds some sort of thread that can maybe link of Nakano's cave. Oh, it's the tartan.
Yes.
She finds a bit of the MacLeod clan tartan in Nakano's cave and goes to New York where Connor MacLeod was registered as the last... I mean, he goes around telling everyone, I'm kind of MacLeod, I'm kind of MacLeod.
Meanwhile, when MacLeod sees her, he actually sees her before then on the news talking about this archaeological discovery, and he flashes back to a romance that he had during the French Revolution with a red-headed lady.
Who looks just like her.
Because she's played by the same actress. And there's this whole bit that plays out of they have this whole romance, and then it gets caught up in the revolution. He's going to get his head chopped off, but a mate of his, who is also an immortal, knocks MacLeod out and takes his place instead for basically no reason.
Well, I think he's just like, I'm sick of being immortal. Yeah. I would like to die, please.
And then when MacLeod eventually does get out, this redheaded version of Alex, the archaeologist, has already married and had children. It's very, very sad.
Yeah, I mean, it has very little consequence on the film.
Yeah, could have not been in there that whole bit.
They basically just do it so they can flash to some other countries and points in time.
Yeah.
And then another thread pops up is that this detective, because in the first film, MacLeod is being pursued for like the murder, the beheading that guy in the car park.
Yes.
So this guy, there's a cop who hasn't let that go.
I can't let that go.
And so like he's like, oh yeah, because in this they go back to calling him Russell Nash.
Yeah.
And so he's like, Nash is back. I'm going to nail his ass.
The reason that he's taken it so personally is that apparently, since the events of the first film ends with Nash / MacLeod on a hill in Scotland being all happy with Brenda Wyatt, his girlfriend from the first film, the forensics expert. This cop reveals at this point that 7 years ago, which would have been 1 year after the events of the first film, 7 years ago, they scraped Brenda Wyatt off of a highway in Scotland.
Yeah.
Nash walked away without a scratch on him. So he basically thinks that Connor MacLeod / Russell Nash murdered his girlfriend. And that's why he's pursuing him still. Which is a nice way of, like, sad, nice way of tying up the bow as to why Brenda isn't his girlfriend anymore, isn't in this film, like, you know.
Yeah, totally. So he's, like, pursuing Nash. And that storyline goes absolutely nowhere.
Yeah,
That one, again, does not need to be in there. So then you've got, like, Connor is just kind of like knocking about New York. You get a bit where he goes and meets an old mate and like does some sort of like like does like kendo or like some sword training
in a Buddhist temple.
In a Buddhist temple,
and then Kane shows up. Kane shows up. He's like, "I'm going to fight you, mate. I'm going to fight you. You've had this coming for 400 years." And McLeod goes, "You can't fight me here, Jack. It's a Buddhist temple. We immortals will never clash swords on holy ground." And Kane goes, "Give a shit!" And then they fight.
Yeah, he obviously doesn't think he doesn't think Buddhism is a real religion.
Even the Kurgan wouldn't break that rule. Even the Kurgan. Kane's just like bothered.
Yeah,
Darth Vader.
They have this really stupid fight where they're like, for some reason, in this like Buddhist temple, which seems to be going under some renovations, there's a trampoline in there for some reason, where they both jump off a trampoline and then they like swing off of ropes from the ceiling like they're Tarzan. And then Kane has the upper hand on McLeod. Mm. He's down on his knees. He's about to deliver the final blow, the coup de grace, take his head off. And then McLeod gets his samurai sword out and blocks the blow, and it shatters his sword into pieces. And then Kane is like, well, 400 years waiting, I can be patient. And then he turns into a bird because he's got magic powers and flies away. The thing is that Kane still had his sword. So if anything, he was in an even better position then to have killed Connor, because he was on his knees and now he's just destroyed his sword. But then he's like, nah, we've got about 40 minutes left of the film. I guess I'll go away for a bit.
I can only think that the producers thought that the earlier scenes would have lasted, taken up more screen time, like genuinely.
Yeah. I'll tell you what does take up a lot of screen time. Any romantic scene. There are like three kind of like sex scenes in this.
Yeah, having sex scenes with the same actress in two parallel timelines, the one from the French Revolution and the one from modern day New York.
Yeah, and then you also get a scene with Mary Van Peebles and a prostitute.
Which is a bit full on, guys.
All of them are a bit full on. Like the final sex scene between Connor and Alex goes on forever. Like it just, every time you thought they were going to cut away, they just cut to a different shot. Just being like, they're still going at it. Yeah. They're still going at it. It was grinding away.
It was really awkward. They were just grinding and grinding and grinding and grinding and grinding and grinding and grinding. Forever, guys. It was horrible.
Yeah. In these films, whenever there's like explosions or someone has the quickening, it always goes on for way too long. The same thing can be said about these like romantic scenes.
It was so awkward. We were just like sat next to each other on the sofa.
It's never going to end, is it?
Gonna stop.
And it had this really repetitive music that just kept on looping round and round. So it actually felt, you know, like a record skipping.
Yeah.
But with Lam Lam just boinking away.
And I read a bit of trivia that both Christoph Lamchop and the actress whose name is Deborah Unger, who also is in the first Silent Hill movie, by the way, guys. I read that they both had the option of sending body doubles to shoot the love scene. And they both went, nah, fancy a piece of that.
Yeah.
Which is super creepy.
Yeah, they probably felt differently about it when it probably took them 2 weeks to shoot that scene, just because it just goes on for so bloody long.
Oof.
Anyway, so now
McLeod goes back to Scotland.
Yeah, Alex still hasn't figured out that he is immortal, despite seeing him get stabbed by Kane.
Yeah.
And going to his apartment and just seeing all these pictures of him, like, in sort of, like, the French Revolution and like in World War One and things like that. She still hasn't pieced together that maybe there's something up about this guy. He goes to Scotland to try and rebuild his sword, which he is utterly shit at.
He's forgotten how to make swords and apparently sword fight. In eight years, he's forgotten everything.
Yeah, despite the fact that he won the prize in the first film and therefore should know everything, he actually knows nothing. And then Alex goes to find him.
She just manages to find him in the middle of the Scottish Highlands.
Yeah, she's like figured it out now. She's like, oh, yeah, it's so obvious now, I feel silly.
She knows exactly where he is, and he just looks up. He's not surprised. He just looks up, laughs, and goes, hey, I thought you'd find me.
Yeah, and she brings him this bit of metal from Nakano's cave that was used to build a sword, and it's basically, oh, here's the sword starter kit from Nakano's cave. Now you can make that sword you always wanted. And then we get this montage scene of him making the sword, and just shot after shot after shot of him standing on different cliff tops in Scotland swinging a sword around, the only reason you can tell it's any passage of time is because in every shot he's wearing a different coat or jumper. And it's, you know, like if you watch a Rocky film, like I would say, like, it's a bit like Rocky IV, where, like, you know, like he climbs up a mountain, but to like a really pumping song to like get your blood, yeah, get you going. This is done to something that just sounds like Enya, or like some, it's like some Celtic folk music. So, like, yeah, like a montage is meant...
I'll do this in the background. Okay.
A montage is meant to show a passage of time and someone getting better at something. This is just him doing the same thing for 2 minutes in different coats on different clifftops. Also, how do you get better at sword fighting by not fighting anybody? He just stands there swinging it in the breeze. And that's it. And it's at this point that we also be like, hey, Connor, do you remember your son that you left in Marrakesh?
You left the dude in Marrakesh, man. He's home alone.
Yeah, like, because there's a bit where, like, basically, Kane goes to Connor's old apartment and Connor's gone. And then the phone rings and the answer phone picks it up. And it's his son being like, Dad, did you forget about me?
Yeah, he even says, in case you've forgotten, the phone number is Marrakesh 4421.
Yeah. So then basically what happens is, like, Kane calls up and gets his son. He pretends to be MacLeod and gets his son.
With the power of illusion.
Yeah, gets him to come over to New York to then, I guess, I don't know, to either kill him or to try and draw MacLeod back.
His plan works.
Yeah, because MacLeod gets a call from his mate in Marrakesh, who's just kind of like, mate, what the fuck are you doing in Scotland?
Yeah.
Which is a fair question anyway, but he thinks that MacLeod has asked him to go to New York. So he hightails it.
Mm-hmm. To the airport. Kane disguises himself as MacLeod with the power of illusion. Picks up his son, bundles him in the car, suddenly reveals his true Kaney nature.
Yeah.
The kid is freaked out.
There's another bit of fan service we get here is, so in the first film you get the scene where the Kurgan and Brenda are driving around in the car and the Kurgan is driving around like a maniac just going we get this now with Kane doing that with MacLeod's son James in the car,
John
just going crazy. But like this time with added magic, like he plays chicken with a plane that turns out to be an illusion. There's this amazing bit where like Mary Van Peebles just rips off the steering wheel of the car, waves it outside the window, gives it to the kid, goes, here, you drive, and then just starts flipping everybody off.
No, this is the best bit about it. There's not even anyone there. There's no one else on the street. He's just randomly flipping the bird out the window at nothing.
At mounds of snow by the side of the road or something.
Yeah, that's how mad he is. He's a maniac. He flips off the snow.
Yeah, he's a crazy man. And then
MacLeod like meets
He gets pulled over by the police. He gets arrested. Like the detective story that goes nowhere. Literally goes nowhere because they arrest him. They go like, admit it, MacLeod. Admit you killed your wife. And he's like, I'm not saying anything. And he's like, well, we don't have anything on him, so I best we gotta let him go. It's like, why would you arrest somebody if you have absolutely nothing on them and then just be like, you better confess or else we're gonna use all that evidence we don't have against you.
Why write that scene into the film?
Yeah.
Because like, it's not, that's the last we see of the cops. That's the big ending of the cop story.
Yeah, now. Yeah. They're just kind of like, I'll get you one of these days, MacLeod. And he's
maybe
just,
in
yeah, and he's just kind
the
of
next
like,
film.
Yeah, he's like, eh, don't think so. And then he goes and finds...
They're in like a power station in New Jersey?
Yeah, something like that. There's another scene on Holy Ground, which all turns out to be an illusion.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's an amazing bit of Mario Van Peebles action where he basically rags on MacLeod for being an immortal who can't bear children. And just, do you remember that?
He's like,
which is kind of funny because, like, I guess your immortal pecker just wasn't up to the pecking. Which is kind of like, dude, but you are also immortal, so you're just as impotent, really.
Yeah.
As
you've
as
been in a cave for 400 years.
Yeah, with your two bros, one of which you killed after you got out. I don't know what you guys got up to into that cave.
It's like, what happens in the cave stays in the cave.
Yeah. So that just kind of happens just as an excuse for more of like the very 90s dated morphing magic effects.
Yeah.
And then they have a fight in like a big power station, which looks like the power station at the end of Terminator 2.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
And they even have another Terminator 2 kind of moment where Alex shows up and is like, oh, I just thought I would come and help and thought you'd be here for no reason. I just seem to be able to find you wherever the fuck you are. And then obviously that turns out to be Kane in disguise.
Yeah.
And they have a fight.
Yeah, there's a good bit where McLeod slices Kane sideways across the belly.
Yeah.
His legs keep running. That's an illusion.
Well, it's not quite... Is it an illusion? It's just that he's... I don't know.
It's Darth Faison.
Yeah, just Darth Faison. I mean, he's a bit of a brick shit house, is Arcane. And then the fight gets progressively more and more boring, and then Kane gets his head cut off. Like the beginning of the fight is quite fun.
But then
it just goes on a bit, and without very much dynamic swordplay. Everything blows up. By this point, I am completely over the quickenings in Highlander films because they just go on for so long. I just do not need to see that many... Because they're explosions for nothing. You know, like if you watch an action film, something explodes, it's got to be cool. It's got to be some sort of reason behind it. It's just literally them blowing up a set.
Yeah. And then that's kind of that, really. We assume he's not immortal anymore.
We would assume that he's mortal now.
He's driving in a car with Alex by his side, who's kissing him. He's got his adopted son, John, in the back. He says, I'm happy now. I've returned to my homeland.
Yes, he's like, I couldn't be happier. And he goes up to a hill, and you get a little bit of voiceover from the first film of his first wife saying,
Heather saying,
light a candle for me and remember me on my birthday. He goes and does on the top of this hill, which has got the Clan MacLeod sword stuck in the ground, and he like lights the candle, and then you see him drive off, and then just before the credits roll, a flash of lightning hits the sword, suggesting, oh, maybe there's more Highlanders.
I wanted a zombie hand to come up.
Yes.
In the book, Ramirez is buried in the same grave. Just saying, guys.
Yeah. Just like if you just heard Sean Connery sort of go, you called? Ramirez! And that's kind of the film.
Yep, I mean, that totally is the film.
So, like, let's talk about the good bits. Like, the good bits are Mario Van Peebles.
Mario Van Peebles!
He fucking crushes it. Where it falls down is it just yo-yos. It just seems to be a film of, like, people going to different countries and then, like, following each other backwards and
flipping forwards. We're in Morocco, we're in Japan, we're in America, we're in Scotland, we're back in Morocco, we're back in Scotland.
Yeah, there's all these bits that don't go anywhere. Like, the whole flashback bit with Sarah.
Oh, we're in France,
That didn't really serve any purpose. The whole bit with the detective, that didn't really serve any purpose in the film either. There are bits where I just feel like it drags.
Yeah.
It's quite draggy. Any bits of just like all the bits kind of with like Alex's character wasn't very interesting. Like what I still can't reach something about an archaeological dig. I don't know what she was.
Yeah.
What that was all about. And I've got to say, like, Connor MacLeod, I'm just really not sure about him as a character.
I'll tell you what, though. This time, after having done The Adventure Begins last time and not having him there, I was really, really happy to see Christoph Lamb, the Highland Man, this time He was just, he's older. He's beefier, like we discussed. Mm. He looks like he's just matured into himself a bit more. He's cut his hair short. He doesn't have those ridiculous long flowing locks anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Because the whole thing I have with, his character, I think I probably like Connor MacLeod more for Christoph Lambeau than the actual character.
Yeah.
But it's like the way he plays him is very weird. Like the bits in Scotland, like with Ramirez and then the bits with Nakano, he's very naive.
Mm.
And then suddenly he just changes in every other bit of time. He's suddenly this really cocky.
Well, he's lived 400 years.
There just doesn't seem to be this kind of consistency.
I think it's a
with his character, because he does these wisecracks and stuff like that, which just kind of don't sit right with
me. I'm 32. I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago. How different would I be in 400 years?
I can appreciate that. I totally get that, but I just there's still something about it that I just don't think it just seems clunky. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
True that.
It's just, or maybe it's just like these wisecracks just do not sound right coming out of Lamla. I love hearing them, yeah. But they just do not sound quite...
Wisecracks like that need to be coming out the mouth of like a biker mice from Mars or something.
Yeah, it's like listening to Christoph Lambert deliver lines is like listening to a band where something is out of tune and you're not quite sure what it is. And you're just kind of like, something ain't right here, people.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. It's everything.
Yeah, it's everything. So that's kind of the film.
Yeah.
So maybe we should have a little quick detour now to Rules Corner.
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 Rules Corner. Rules. Okay, we're back in Rules Corner, where we break down what the fuck is meant to be going on in the world of Highlander. So... this one has, like, so now, that page that you've got that about all about Planet Zeist, just tear that out. That doesn't matter. All the stuff from the animated TV series, that never even came close to counting. You get rid of that. What you can add to now is the power of illusion that we've got. We've got magic, okay? And that's fine. It's funny that... Did Connor McLeod actually use any magic? There's some bits in this.
No. Doesn't
no.
have it. He gets good at, he learns a skill of stealing a sword from someone.
Yes, okay.
But that's a skill.
But that's a skill. That is not magic. Okay. And like the only things that are like have kind of changed in this now is that like when you kill somebody and you get the, and the quickening happens, is that the dead person's body floats.
Yeah.
That was a new thing.
It was good.
Oh, we didn't talk about that. Basically, when Nakano gets his head cut off, Nakano's severed head on the ground looks up at Kane and he goes, "There can only be one, but it will not be you."
It's freaky.
It's freaky. And it's kind of like, oh, well, ooh, that's never happened.
That
before.
Is some Pamela Voorhees severed head shit
yeah.
right there.
So, that's kind of weird. I'm just thinking like,
I mean, it's no real... they don't really introduce many new rules.
No,
they?
There's not a lot of new rules. Just like a few like stylistic elements, like the floating bodies. Obviously, the magic thing, we've never seen that before. The big thing with the rules is just the fact that like if you forget about immortals, apparently they don't exist.
Yeah.
Like it just... that is the big thing, is that like what the fuck was happening with the ending of the first film?
The Kurgan could have just locked everybody in a cave and he would have won.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, apparently not. Apparently that would have made him mortal because, like, it just makes you think that maybe is there just, like, one admin guy who is just, like, looking, trying to keep track of where all the immortals are, probably on Zeist, trying to just be kind of like, I think that's all of them. I'll press the button now. Beep. Okay. And he's mortal now.
Undo. Oh, we forgot one.
Yeah.
Quick.
Oh, no.
Control Z. Control Z.
I'm really drunk. I'm sorry, boys. I just do not know what I'm doing. So, that's weird. The other thing, which I think may have come up in the first film, but I don't think ever was like maybe expressly stated in the first film, is the thing that like when you kill another immortal and you experience the quickening, you absorb all of their knowledge and memories.
Mm-hmm.
I do not remember that being stated in the film, although you kind of maybe assume that.
Yeah. So what would McLeod have gotten from the Kurgan when he killed him? Would he have absorbed any power from him?
He would have just kind of like got that little like memory of him getting it on with Candy, probably.
Boom dang.
Yeah.
But maybe that makes sense though, why that one was like the strongest quickening of all, because if the Kurgans absorb the strength of every other Highlander he's killed, and then there's only two, and then McLeod kills him, then he's got the strength of all the Highlanders that have ever been.
Yes, but if he absorbed all the memories of all of those Highlanders, then he would have known that no one has killed Kane or either of his two cronies.
That's true.
But then he was kind of like, oh, there seems to be an admin slip up. I'm just going to go with it.
Well, so, Tom, I'm afraid Rules Corner is looking a little kind of dark and dusty at the moment.
It just doesn't make sense. So, yeah, shall we go back to a simpler time?
Let's go back to a simpler time.
Before all the rules got just... all mangled up.
Have you got your dressing gown on, Tom?
I do.
Yeah, you got your slippers on?
I'm putting them on now. Putting them on now. There we go.
Okay, you got a glass of brandy to hand?
Yes.
Violet?
Yep.
Okay, well, settle in.
Mm.
Let me tuck the blanket up over you.
Lovely.
Hospital corner's there for you. And we'll settle in for story time with Toddly T. This is the section of the podcast where I read from Highlander, the novelization of the first film, written by Mr. Gary Kilworth, Gary with two R's, Unfortunately, as of this current date, Gary Kilworth has still not responded to any of my messages asking for an interview or any kind of quote about this work. Hopefully next time, guys, I'm going to keep it up. I'm going to keep rooting for it. This time I thought I'd read a little section that begins on page 106 of the book. Now, this is because this film that we just watched ends with MacLeod revisiting Heather's grave, his very first wife. This relates to Heather. So what happens in the first film is MacLeod gets kicked out of his village in old Scotland because they've discovered he's immortal. They think he's got the devil in him. He's got his hands are in like stocks. He's all like tied up. And then like it cuts and it's 5 years later. He's free. He's fine. He's married to Heather. He's living a good life. Mm. He's happy. This section of the book, Tom, fills in those 5 years.
Ooh!
I'm not going to read the whole 5 years because it's long, but I'm going to read the first bit. The only bit that I'm going to skip over is a fairly long section where he basically gets out of the stocks by rubbing the rope on a sharp bit of stone. So he gets he breaks the rope, gets free. So he's just gotten himself free from the stocks. Okay. Here we go. Story time with Toddly T. When morning came, he travelled south, eating a few roots to sustain him. After a long, arduous journey, he reached a croft, outside of which was a lass milking a cow. He went to her. Can you spare some of that milk? Sorry, he went to her.
Can you spare some of that milk? I have no money, but I can work.
The girl looked a little frightened, and he guessed it was his appearance that was bothering her. She called out, Father! An old man came out of the croft holding a hand axe. What? This man wants some milk.
I can work, said Connor. I'm not begging.
The old man looked him up and down. Where are you from?
My name's Connor MacLeod from Glenfinnan in the north.
A MacLeod, are you? And on the road? Connor did not want to frighten them with talk of witchcraft, so he said,
I wounded a man. A fight over a woman. I was drunk.
The old man's face stiffened. You'll find nothing to drink here, except the milk, maybe, if I've a mind to give you some. He seemed to be studying Connor's build. Connor stood up straight, filling his chest with air. Can you chop wood? Said the other.
I can.
The axe was flung at his feet, the blade burying itself in the turf. Would you be fighting over me next, Mr. MacLeod? He laughed.
I've done enough fighting. I've a mind to be a farmer now. I'm looking for a quiet life.
And that is how their romance blossoms.
Ah, well, that's lovely. I mean, why, he's like, I didn't want to scare him with talk of witchcraft, so I told him I was a violent drunk.
Yeah, at which point his daughter is like, seems nice.
Yeah, and yeah, and the dad is kind of like, well, I'm not sure if she's really my daughter, I don't care.
That is basically as much detail as the book goes into. It's a little glimpse into what we missed with the film.
Okay, that's good, because it does just kind of like these films like to do, just drop you into situations and just like, fucking swim, audience.
Well, I think we're kind of done talking about Highlander 3 the Sorcerer, aka Highlander 3 the Magician, aka Highlander 3 the Final Dimension, aka Highlander 3 the Final Conflict.
Whoa, yeah. The Final Dimension? What dimension?
Yeah, there's not really many dimensions.
Don't. Are we going back to Zeist?
Well, where we are going is Highlander
Endgame.
Endgame.
From 2000.
Yeah, I'm really, really interested to see Naughty's Highlander.
So this is the film that is going to cross the film series with old Chrissy Lamlams.
Yeah,
with the TV series. The TV series, I think, like started in 1992.
For clarity, this is not the animated series that we talked about last episode.
This is the live action.
Live action.
That started in 1992 and. So this film, like, again, it's another continuity that you've got going on in like the Highlander, because like this film doesn't make any reference to it, and I assume the TV series didn't make any reference. Well, I don't know.
Maybe
We've never seen it, so we'll see how well they explain the lore of the TV series.
Could go either way.
Yeah, this is the only film as well that's got like a UK 18 certificate.
Ooh.
All the other ones are 15s.
Oh, so it's going to be a little bit gory, maybe.
Maybe. I mean, we've had you know, a fair bit of head lopping. I'm intrigued to say either that or just like the sex scenes in this one are going to be fucking banging.
Please no, Tom. Please.
Yeah, no, I don't take it anymore. I don't want to see any more of those.
Well, yeah, thanks for listening, guys. As always, it's great to hear from you. So if you've got anything to say, you've got any questions, you think we've got something wrong, do drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. It's Bitter End Pod. We're always stoked to hear from you guys. And please do leave a review on iTunes if you have the time or the inclination.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. But yeah, thanks for listening. My one final thought on The Sorcerer. This, you know, like out of three films now with Christoph Lamb, this is the only one that has not referenced It's a Kind of Magic.
Thank God.
Yet it is the only film that has had magic. Come on, guys. That's a swing and a miss right there.
Get it together.
And also, we're over halfway now.
High five, buddy.
It can only get better from here, right?
Things go. I'm not going to sing it.
Fuck that. We'll just see you guys next time.
Bye.